people leading out of pride is probably one of the most destructive things that can happen in society. When I look back at the 20th century and all the uniquely horrible things that happened there all over the world, the destruction, the killing of millions of innocent people, usually that was done out of pride. I know that's a big, heavy statement to say there, but I think that whether you're the head of a department in a small consulting firm or whether you're a pastor, if you're doing it out of pride, destruction will follow.
Welcome to the Leadership Podcast. What does it mean to lead well in the 21st century? We speak to significant leaders from around the world to learn how to shift our leadership up a gear and become the leaders we're called to be. We learn from leaders from the creative industries, law, church, charities, and more as we seek to make a positive impact in the world. Patrick Lencioni is one of the founders of the Table Group and is the pioneer of the organizational health movement. He's probably best known as the author of The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, a popular business fable that explores work, team dynamics, and offers solutions to help teams perform better. In addition to Five Dysfunctions of a Team, he's written 10 other business books, including The Advantage, Why Organizational Health Trumps Everything Else in Business, Overcoming the Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and Death by Meeting. He has sold over 6 million books and has been translated into more than 30 languages. As president of the Table Group, Pat spends his time speaking and writing about leadership, teamwork, and organizational health, and consulting with executives and their teams. The widespread appeal of Lencioni's leadership models have yielded a diverse base of speaking and consulting clients, including a mix of Fortune 500 companies, professional sports organizations, the military, nonprofits, schools, and churches. Pat addresses thousands of leaders each year at world-class organizations and national conferences. Consistently the top-rated keynote speaker at major events, Pat shares his insights and inspires his audience through his accessibility, humor, and storytelling. Named in Fortune magazine as one of the 10 new gurus you should know, Pat and his work has been featured in USA Today, Bloomberg Businessweek, and Harvard Business Review, to name a few. Prior to founding his firm, he worked as a corporate executive for Sybase, Oracle, and Bain & Company. Pat lives in San Francisco with his wife and four sons. You're going to love this interview of Patrick Lencioni as he speaks candidly about his faith and how he became a leader. He also talks about the importance of humility as one of the essential features of all great leadership. Patrick, welcome to the Leadership Podcast. It's lovely to meet you again. We met very briefly in Chicago at the Global Leadership Summit. You set the stage on fire, and I think I was the fire extinguisher that came on afterwards and kind of got rid of all the
atmosphere. I don't think so, but I remember meeting you very well. Yeah, it was great. I'm glad we can finally do this across
Excellent.
The pond.
Thanks for making time. And I wonder if we could start by talking about your early steps into leadership. Many people don't think they are leaders. They can see leadership in other people, but not in themselves. How did you first know that you were a leader?
That's a great question. You know, I think early in my life, I was like a captain and a leader in things. If I'm honest about it, probably because I wanted to be important when I was a youngster. You know, people said, you should be a leader or a captain of your team or whatever. I was the president of my junior high and of my high school and all that. And I was a leader in college. But I think when you're young, you're like, I want people to believe I'm important. And then later, I think true leadership comes when you realize that something is in need and nobody's doing anything about it, and you humbly step up. And for me, I can't be a leader without faith, because if I think that it's me doing the leading, then it's going to be pride-based. And now it feels like it's an answer to a call.
Yeah. I think I heard you say that from the stage. And also in your book, The Ideal Team Player, you talk about humility as being one of the key things to be looking for in leaders. So how did that transition take place? Because some people never make that transition. It is all about themselves. It is all about my ego. And that can make you a really destructive kind of leader. How did you change from being a leader that was about wanting to be important to seeing something that needed to be done in the world, that kind of more humble approach?
You know, I would say you see that when you realize, when you contemplate ultimate things, like why does my life exist and one day I'm going to die, and all this stuff I've learned about Jesus and about my faith, and it's like, am I really living that? I think that when you experience some level of success, Krish, and you realize ultimately it doesn't satisfy, you start to think, okay, there's something else here. And I always said that I think the greatest gift of being successful was coming to realize that it didn't matter.
Wow.
Whereas people, if they're still aspiring to more success, they keep thinking, well, there's something just around the corner that's going to satisfy me. And relatively early in my life, I think I kind of exceeded my goals in a worldly sense. And it was like, well, if this is all there is, then this is clearly not the right ladder to be climbing. So I think that's part of it. And I, God's grace of him just going, I'm going to bring you down to your knees to realize this is not all about you. And you said earlier how dangerous this is. One might make the argument, I mean, you know, the root of all sin is pride. And people leading out of pride is probably one of the most destructive things that can happen in society. When I look back at the 20th century and all the uniquely horrible things that happened there all over the world, the destruction, the killing of millions of innocent people, usually that was done out of pride. Yeah. Somebody saying, I am God, I am going to force you to do things you don't want to or kill you. And so anyway, I know that's a big heavy statement to say there, but I think that whether you're the head of a department in a small consulting firm or whether you're a pastor or whether you're a principal of a school, if you're doing it out of pride, destruction will follow.
Our culture seems to celebrate the kind of proud leader, though. So you can think about the leaders often in tech industries, you know, they don't listen to anybody. They're about kind of making their mark in the world, a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs used to talk about it. But we celebrate that drivenness, that nothing can stop me. Everyone else is stupid. They don't know how to do anything. How do you develop humility in a culture that celebrates pride in its leaders?
Yeah, and you know something, Krish, most people listening to this, and you and I both, are relatively young. I think this is a function of life in the world since the 60s. You know, in the 50s, that was not cool to be that way. I think that something happened in the world and in my lifetime, because I was born in the 60s, where that became more and more and more acceptable, whereas today, infamy and fame are almost seen as the same thing. And I love what you said about so many of these technology leaders are famous, everybody knows what they look like. But what we don't realize is some of the best leaders in the world, in fact, the best leaders in the world, you wouldn't know if they sat down on this podcast right now and somebody saw them sitting here. There's a company here in the United States that would have to be considered the most successful company in the United States over the last 40, 50 years, and that's called Southwest Airlines. And even now, we hope they're gonna be able to make it work, but they've never had a layoff since 1970 when they started. They've always made money, but more importantly, they treat their employees and their customers well. People love working there. It's a total testament to the right kind of leadership. The CEO for the last almost 20 years is Gary Kelly. And you wouldn't know him if you sat down next to him. He's a wonderful man, but he's not famous. And then there's some 25-year-old kid who started a startup that's never made money, but he's on the cover of a magazine every week, and he's brash, and he can be kind of an a-hole. Excuse my French there. That's French. And so, yeah, society almost celebrates these people. And the best leaders in the world, though, are not famous. The best leaders in the world aren't looking for that. They're just not. You're a man of faith. This world sees faith as foolishness.
Yeah.
You know, once at GLS, I was there where you and I met years ago, and a guy from Australia gave a talk. He wrote a book about humility. He made it clear. He said, before Jesus, people thought that being humble was pretty much foolishness. Yeah. Like to lower yourself to somebody else. And you know, the world in this post-Christian world tends to think, oh, but this is just natural. No, it was like, this came from Christ who said, lower yourself, turn the other cheek, pray for those who persecute you. Know that the world hated me first. It's going to hate you too. And that's okay. In fact, rejoice. Well, that was radical, in your face, countercultural craziness to people then. So much so that they rebelled against Jesus violently. Well, today we think, oh yeah, humility, man, that's great. It's cool. Well, the world really doesn't think it's cool. It says, get your own, be famous, be brash.
That's right.
The worst thing that comes out of this, Krish, I'm sorry, this is a long answer, is false humility, people that know how to pretend they're humble in order to get praise. Because that is so dangerous.
Oh, I'm with you. And I love that you've made that a priority in your writing. But it doesn't happen naturally, as you say, in a culture that celebrates it. It's all about self-promotion. That's how you get more influence. What are the kind of disciplines or practices? I mean, the back of your book tells me you've sold 6 million copies of your works, and they're translated into 30 languages. Now, for most people, that would blow their minds. And how do you remain humble with that kind of success? What do you actually do?
Well, it's like this. If you're not humble, you will not experience peace in your heart and your mind. And I will share with you, I don't think I was ever a naked pursuer of fame and fortune, but I probably was unconsciously faking it in terms of like, you know, one of the most powerful things that Jesus says in the Bible is you can't serve two masters, right? And I think what that says is you can't serve God, which is humility. I am not God. He is God. And therefore I want to be humble and obedient. And I want to do what I want to do. I want to be famous. I want to be wealthy. I want to have power. You can't do both. You right. can't serve both God and mammon. Hmm. And yet so many of us, including me, were like, I think I'm going to give this a shot. I think I can do both. And you can't. And so for me, when you said, what do you do? I think for me, I had to realize that I was not encountering peace of mind and heart and soul in serving myself. And so even if you don't want to be humble, it will pursue you in terms of your restlessness. Like St. Augustine said, you know, our hearts will not rest till they rest in God. So for me, I just came to realize I wanted peace and I didn't have it. And so this whole idea of thinking I mattered was pretty empty. I prayed one day. I remember the day I prayed this. I prayed, okay, God, I don't want to be, the parable of the sower was, you know, like when Jesus said, you know, that some seed lands on the path and some lands next to it and some lands in the soil that's around thorn and it grows, but it gets choked off by the thorns, the cares of the world. And that was the third level. And I was like, that's me. I'm pretty proud of myself. I made it to level three. I honestly used to think, well, level three is better than level 2 and 1.
Yeah.
And there's no grading on a curve. And one day right. I realized I was at mass and I just got a communion. I prayed, God, take me out of level three. I want to get to level four where it produces a yield. And I knew that humility was the problem.
Wow.
And I totally felt God saying, Pat, are you sure? Because this is going to be hard for you. Mm. And I said, yeah, what else can I do? And that's when I went through a profound period of emptiness, which was the mercy of God saying, I am going to deprive you of all of your self-indulgent delusions and bring you down to nothing so that I can build you up again in reality. And for me, it's waking up every day. And the first thing is giving myself to Jesus and
saying, Jesus, so make me.
Sometimes it's 20 minutes later that I start to fail, or sometimes it's 2 hours later. And then throughout the day, I have to constantly try to pray and try to bring myself back to him. I cannot be humble without him because he's who I humble myself to. So anyway, I didn't realize I was going to be doing a testimony today.
Thank you.
I can't lie. This is the source of it.
No, I love it. It's interesting that for some leaders, they're nervous about being public about their faith if they have it. Faith is the kind of taboo area. We don't want to talk about that because it might negatively impact my business or my leadership. And therefore, I don't want to be open about these things. And some of that is due, I think, to some of the associations. You know, if I tell you I'm a person of faith, you're going to guess which political party that I vote for, what the hot button issues are for me, and I don't want to be associated with that. But do you think there are other reasons why leaders might want to not be open about their faith?
I love this question because I've struggled with this too. And I've gotten better at it in the sense of, I think what it comes down to is this, it's humility again. It depends why you're doing it. And Jesus once said, you know, if you're ashamed of me, I'm going to be ashamed of you. So if I just go into it, but if I do it in love, but if I'm also willing to suffer for it, but I'm not seeking suffering, I'm not like, I'm going to tell you my faith just so you can hate me and I can be a martyr. No, it's like, let me in love share my faith with you because this is who I am. Mm. And if you hate me for it, I'll love you anyway. But I don't want to say it in a way that's going to make you uncomfortable. But if it makes you uncomfortable, there's probably something to that that's good for you. Mm. And if you go into it detached from pride or fear, I find this, Krish, it's crazy. 19 and a half times out of 20, people are like, thank you, that's great. Wow. And then that one half time out of 20, when somebody like doesn't like it or criticizes you for it, you just say, thank you, God. God bless them. And sorry you feel that way. This is who I am. But when you get bitter and you challenge people to, and when I was younger, I was like, how dare people tell me I can't share my faith? Then suddenly I'm doing it for pride. Wow. So I share my faith in humility and in graciousness for them. And if anybody praises me for it, I give that to God. And if anybody persecutes me or criticizes me for it, I give that to God too.
But that's
until
great.
I really came to terms with, and not that I don't struggle with it, humility, I couldn't do it because then I was like, I'm going to show you. I'm a Christian, darn it. You're going to listen.
Do you think it could also be that linked to that humility, that as a leader, if I tell you I'm a Christian, you might think that I'm a doormat? that I'm not going to be the strong leader that everyone's expecting me to be. And being a humble leader also, you might walk all over me. And, you know, leadership is about maintaining control and power. And therefore, I can't let my guard down because that's going to be a sign of weakness. And therefore, I'm going to be walked over. Do you think that might be another element why leaders are nervous to be both humble or open about their faith?
I think that there are some people that think that Jesus and faith is wimpy. But that's just not who Jesus was. Like the most courageous studly guy ever. We don't realize that when he was saying things like humble yourself, love your neighbor, don't be proud, that was flying in the face. That was speaking truth to power. He did it in kindness, but it was really frustrating people. So we tend to think he was this guitar playing hippie wearing Birkenstocks going, hey everybody, let's hug. Yeah. And he was anything but that. And so I think that when we really come to terms with who Jesus is and who the saints were and how courageous they were, we can let go of that. I think that other people, non-believers who get presented with Jesus, see him as that hippie. And I think they think, man, that's a very wimpy thing. I was reading a book called Render Unto Caesar by a guy I know, Archbishop Shepu. And it's a great book about how to live in the modern age and still be a follower of Jesus. And he talks about how people see it as a soft thing. In fact, he quoted somebody saying, Christianity is the religion of losers. Huh. Ted Turner said that. He said, Christianity is a religion for losers. And so yes, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And then we realize, yeah, if we're losers in the world, then we're winners in heaven. That doesn't mean we're seeking failure. But if somebody says, oh, you're a Christian, you're a loser. We're like, okay, if that's how you see it, I'm going to love you. Then this loser is going to love you anyway.
Hey, a lot of your books, as we said, translated all around the world. It's hard to go into an airport. Well, it's hard to go into an airport now because of lockdown. but normally it's hard to go into an airport and not see one of your books on a shelf somewhere. Can you talk a little bit about your writing process? Where does it begin? They often seem to be that you've spotted a common problem and you've looked to find a solution. Is it normally out of that that you begin?
Yeah, I love the question. There's two ways. There's like the writing process and then the idea coming up process. And I am not a researcher like a Jim Collins, who's one of my favorite business authors. When I met him years ago, I said to him, you know, Jim, I don't do what you do. I don't go sit in a room and with reams of data. I'm out in the field working with people. And he said, what you're doing is totally valid. Because it's face validity. You see how things work and you write about that. And if your readers respond to it and it works, it works. And I was glad he said that because I was like, oh my gosh, because I'm not a data guy. So my ideas all come from being in a room with a CEO or with a group of leaders throughout my career and going, oh my gosh. I wrote a book years ago called Death by Meeting. And I remember over the course of-
You had me at the title of that book.
Right.
I was there. I thought, yeah, most of the meetings I've ever been in felt like death. So you had me.
I came up with that, Krish, because I was sitting in meetings with this one CEO in his company, and I could tell they were just so bored out of their mind. And I was too, as a consultant. I remember thinking, there has to be a reason for this, and it can't be a good one. And I remember just sitting there listening to them going, what? Oh, this is what's going on. And this is what's going on. So it's all field research. But once I come up with an idea, I don't ever sit down and go, I should write a book. What should it be about? I never do that. It's always like, oh my gosh, here's an idea. And I come back to my office and I say, hey, everybody, what do you think of this idea? And they'll go, you should write an article about that. Or they go, that's a book. Mm-hmm. I go, I don't know if it's a book. No, that's a book. Then what I do is over the course of probably about 9 months, I write and then I stop writing and I go for 2 days to a hotel, and then I'm in the shower, I'm exercising, and I'm with a client. So it comes out slowly. It's a very iterative, unpredictable process. Some writers will go and say, I write 20 pages every day. And mine, I'll write 100 pages in a weekend or in a couple days, and then I won't write for 2 weeks. So I'm a very scattered writer.
It's good. They're really effective. And the use of parable, was that inspired by your faith? Did that come from Jesus?
No, I wish I could say, yes, of course. But you know, since I was a kid, I loved writing, and I loved writing fiction. And I took a screenwriting class in college. And I say, I joke around to my father's chagrin, but because, you know, it wasn't very practical and he wanted me to get a good job. And so I really got hooked on screenplays and movies. And so my books, when I first got encouraged to write a book about a theory I came up with by a client, I thought, you know, I just don't want to write a book that people aren't going to read the whole book, because I never finish most business books. Mm-hmm. I read the first couple of chapters and I flip through the rest. And that really bummed me out. I thought, man, if I write a book and nobody finishes it. So I said, why don't I write something that people want to read? And then I thought, you know, I'm going to write a story, and my books are very much more like screenplays than they are like novel. I don't do a lot of detailed character development. I bring it about through their dialogue and through what happens. My goal in writing fables was to capture the reality of business in ways that people say, and I love this when people say, oh my gosh, that scene was exactly what I go through at work. I didn't want them to say, oh, that was silly. I understand the point you're making, but I couldn't relate to the characters. And sometimes people will say, I can relate to the negative character in this book. That was me. And so I wanted it to be realistic. I wanted it to be interesting. I wanted it to be compelling and short. And so that's how it all came about. And then Ken Blanchard, a friend of mine one day, came to me after a talk and said, you know, your books are based in the Bible, don't you? And I was like, yeah, sure, I knew that. And I started to realize, of course, that this is earlier in my faith journey, but that Jesus, you know, is the source of all wisdom, and that anything we come up with is usually just restating something he said.
That's right. Footnotes on Jesus. I like that. You mentioned speaking, and you get to speak in some incredible places. I watched you at the Willow Creek Global Leadership Summit, 9,000 people in the room, 400,000 people watching online around the world. How do you prepare for something like that?
So that's a great question. I prepare, and it depends. You know, sometimes I go to those places and I give a talk I've given many times before. But even still, I kind of prepare and then I stop, and then I don't use my notes or my preparation. The secret to my talk, my speaking, is this. I go up on stage, you'll notice this every time, and I start every talk by saying I'm Catholic, and so I'm going to start with a confession. And I confess how I'm feeling in that moment. And what I do is I smash the window between me and the audience and say, I'm kind of nervous, or this is what I'm thinking, or when I was preparing, I did this. And suddenly, now I'm with a bunch of people who are with me. And so that way, if I forget what I was saying, I say, and I always tell my Myers-Briggs type, I'm an ENFP, and I forget my train of thought, because I do. And now they're part of that. And when I do, I go, oh yeah, see, I just forgot. If I tried to speak like, and I recently did a TED talk, and I had to be a little more formal, and it was nerve-wracking for me. So if I had to go up and memorize a talk and give it a certain way and perform, it would be really unnerving. So I just go up and I say, hey, everybody, here's the deal. This is who I am. There's a lot of people in the room. It's pretty distracting, a little nerve-wracking. So let's do this together. Suddenly, all of my tension goes away. And then if I forget something or I trip and fall, if something crazy happens, like my microphone falls off, that usually works in my favor because they're kind of rooting for me by that point.
Yeah, I love that. And that's a combination, isn't it, of humility, just trying to disarm your audience and connect with them. And you're right, you've turned that into a superpower now, that they're going to be with you however it goes because you've confessed.
And that allows them to engage in the material more than me. Now they're not like evaluating, like, so I want to evaluate his speaking prowess. They kind of forget it's not about me. I'm just this guy. Let's talk about this thing. And then they're into the material. I'm second to that. So good. I like doing it.
The Leadership Podcast is brought to you by World Vision, a global organization with over 70 years of experience working alongside communities, churches, donors, partners, and governments to help the most vulnerable children experience fullness of life. Every 60 seconds, through World Vision's work, a family gets water, a hungry child is fed, a family receives the tools to overcome poverty. World Vision is committed to enable leaders everywhere, especially those leading churches, to be empowered and equipped to make a positive impact in the world. Visit www.wvi.org/leadership to learn more about today's guest, other episodes, and how you and your ministry can partner with World Vision.
So World Vision is a huge global charity committed to helping vulnerable children around the world. And, you know, one of the stats that some of the staff passed on to me the other day, 850 million children around the world go to bed hungry every night. And the needs of the world are sometimes at arm's length for a leader. You know, I've just got my world, I've got my things I've got to order, my success, my business. How do you think we can help leaders, as you said earlier, you know, find a problem in the world that needs solving, not just make it about themselves? How can we help recruit leaders into the kind of global justice vision?
I had a chance years ago, Jimmy Mulatto and I are friends. So I got a chance to go to Colorado Springs and consult to him and his team years ago. And I've known him from GLS and stuff. And so this is a great question. It's one I think about a lot. And the first thing I would say is this. We all think, like, how can we do more to help the people who need help the most? And I think one of the things we have to do is first realize that God puts people in our lives every day that we can help. And if we're trying to feed the hungry in Africa or in South Latin America, and we're not loving on the people right in front of us, there's a problem there. And so when I talk to executives, one of the things I like to say is, you know, I realize many of you would like to retire early and maybe go do missionary work or volunteer in a charity, and that's fantastic. But don't lose sight of the fact that the job you have right now has a greater impact on the lives of the people you lead than you ever realize, on their children, their spouses, their neighbors. And the ministry of managing others and leading others is one that I don't want you to realize when you're on your retirement party or at your deathbed. You probably have a greater impact on the lives of others right now than you will ever have. And even somebody who is like Jimmy is the CEO, the first people he impacts are the people that work directly for him. And if he does that well, then they will impact the lives of others. And then there's a child on the streets of Calcutta that is being served. That's not to say, though, we shouldn't all be looking at the bigger ways we can help too. And that's one of the beauties of World Vision and organizations like it. You're sharing with others the ability to influence their lives. When you get a card or a letter from this person and make a human connection to somebody you're supporting, the gift, and I know this sounds like a cliche, but the real gift is to the giver. I mean, the gift to the child is fantastic. But I've had enough experience with the people I give to now to realize that they really do give to me more than I give to them. I've built a couple houses. I did a YWAM mission down in Tijuana. And there's a guy in Africa who's a missionary, a guy from Kenya that I serve. And they are so joyful and they are so appreciative. And I think, oh my gosh, I give you so little relative to what I have and you are so joyful and appreciative. And so they're really ministering to me in my understanding of what matters. So I guess what I'm trying to say is many of us have angst about how can I do more for others? And God first puts people in our lives directly to serve. And then he gives us the opportunity to serve people at large. And sometimes we discount those and miss the very people. I'm working with pastors right now. I have an organization called The Amazing Parish. I'm Catholic. I work with other churches too, but we have something. And one of the things we're teaching them, in fact, we have a podcast this week about this or a webinar, is that if you're a pastor and you're not first ministering to the people who work in your office, and yet you're trying to save the poor and you're trying to bring people in off the street, and you're trying to do all this thing, there's a discontinuity to that.
I like it. We talk about charity begins at home. And in my household, we're a fostering and adopting household. We have 6 kids that we're in lockdown with. And sometimes I can lose sight of my opportunity to bless the kids in my house. And I'm out trying to save the world, right? So you're right. That's got to be where it starts.
Oh, and it breaks my heart to hear about pastors who give their lives to their church and then their marriage falls apart or their kids struggle.
Yeah,
now, granted,
so
their kids don't necessarily struggle because of what they did. You know, God gives us all struggles and brings out good things through that. But it is so easy. And I think beneath that sometimes is that subtle, I mean, the devil is so clever, that subtle pride that goes, oh, look, I can make a difference out there. And it becomes about us. And we're all susceptible to that. That's not a judgment at all. That's why every day I have to go, okay, God, what do you have for me today? And it's your will, not mine. And that's a painful process that I've had to go through. And I go through it every day.
Like you, I've met quite a few executives who have a vision for retirement and doing good through their retirement. And for a lot of them, as you say, they're in positions of influence in companies already. And yes, they need to bless the people around them. But actually, there's a way they could reorientate the company so that the company itself is doing good in the world. And I don't know why there's sometimes the dichotomy, you know, there's my personal private philanthropy. But then what about this movement they talk about, business for purpose, thinking about how the outputs of my business can actually be doing good in an environmentally, economically sensible way. There's still a way to do that. So there's sometimes that discontinuity you talked about between home and work and the people I work with. But what about actually the direction and purpose of the organization or company that you're working for?
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. And I like to talk about this because most people don't work in an organization that is inherently vocational. The majority of people, you know, there's people that are doctors and teachers and pastors and servants, that it's a vocation. And what's interesting is many of those people lose their way because they get burned out. And then they're like, oh, I don't want to grade these papers, these little kids. I'm sick of them. I want summer to come. And you realize they've lost their vocation. Most of us don't work in companies where that's obvious. And so one of the things I say is create an environment where everyone who comes into contact with your company, you might build tables for companies. And so sometimes it's the way you do it. St. Paul made tents. You know, St. Paul was a tent maker. I'm guessing he wasn't a jerk to the people he made tents for. And I'm guessing he didn't overcharge them or make bad ones, right?
That's right.
So whether you're herding sheep or building tents or making tables or building software, you have to realize that everything you do, but then there is that thing, like, how can we make the mission about that? So it's interesting, something that happened during this pandemic and the shutdown. So my company is relatively small. We're gonna be able to break even during this time. Our revenue went way down, but our people are not gonna lose their jobs or lose their homes or anything like that. Praise God, thank you God for that. So we said, what are we gonna do? Because we started this movement. We said, let's go to CEOs and invite them to ask their employees to take a voluntary pay cut in order to not lay off their colleagues. And we had people who actually said, I hadn't thought of that, I'm gonna do that. We had the pastor of a church think he was gonna lay off some of his staff. He went to his staff and said, hey, would anybody like to take a 10% cut so we can save Mary and John? And somebody said, 10%? I don't do this for the money, I could do more than that. So we said, we wanna do that. But then we said, what are we gonna do? So we took pay cuts, some of us voluntarily, to help our vendors and other businesses. And so we tried to give business or buy business or give gifts to the hotel down the street and the taqueria down the street. Wow. And to one of our vendors who helps us do technology to help them stay in business. I think that this time was an opportunity for us to actually become a little world vision for those people. And some of them were quite poor, some of them were not, but they didn't want to lay off people. I'm sorry, I'm just speaking out loud here and not to make myself look good, because if anybody thinks I think I'm a great guy, it's not because of me. But like, I do a lot of things for free now, and I get the most out of those, I'm not gonna lie. So you can make tables for people that need tables and you can give them away. Like in our company, we do a lot for churches and for nonprofits. And we say, yeah, we charge a lot to that software company because they have a lot of money and they're glad to pay. We're gonna give 20% of our time to these organizations.
That's great.
We have gone down and built homes in Tijuana, our company did twice. But again, when I looked at that, I'm like, oh, this is actually for us. I mean, we built this person a home and they were very grateful, but wow, we got 12 times more out of that.
That's amazing.
You know, let's all find ways that we can serve the poor. The other thing is the poor are really close to us too. The poorest of the poor are in other countries. You know, the poor in the United States are generally well off compared to the poor in other countries. But poverty is deeper than just financial. The greatest poverty is poverty of spirit, poverty of hope. And Mother Teresa once came to the United States. She went to Richmond, California, which is really close to where I am by Oakland. She said, this is the darkest place I've ever been in my life. Wow. And it wasn't because people weren't driving cars and didn't have TV. It was because there was such a poverty of hope. And you go into some of these poor places, and you know this, Krish, you meet these children and they have a smile on their face and they're thanking you, and you give them a pair of shoes and you think you've just given them a lottery ticket for $1 billion. And you start to see poverty a little differently. Not that they don't need shoes and money and everything else, but you're really giving them hope. I think sometimes we tend to think that poverty is something that happens in India or Bangladesh or in Guatemala, and they need us. They totally need us.
A couple of things you're saying there remind me of my favorite movie, which is The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, we just watched it the other day.
Oh, great film to watch in lockdown. The language isn't great, but the story is fantastic. And I love the way that Andy was probably the lowest ranked member of Shawshank Prison. He was not the CEO. He was not the COO. He was not part of the C-suite. He was a prisoner. And yet he found a way to bring light and hope to everybody's life that he touched, even though he didn't have power. I've often used that as a way to help people think about their leadership. So you might not be the ultimate decision maker for your company, but as you said, you have the opportunity to make every touch point that you have with vendors and colleagues and competitors an opportunity to show grace and mercy and compassion. And I love that. And you were talking about this poverty of hope. And the strange thing in The Shawshank Redemption is Andy, the prisoner, is the most hope-filled person in the room. There's something about him that's infectious. I've often used that as a kind of picture of the calling for a Christian. We are people of hope. We might not always have the power that we want, but in every touch point that we have with the rest of the world, we are to be agents of hope and grace and light. And you've kind of joined a few dots for me there in what you've said. Patrick, thank you so much. Thank you for what your writing has done. It's helped me and my little charity that I run for fostering and adoption. I hope we have better meetings than we used to because we've read your book. And
so glad to hear that. Thank you. You know what I would share with your listeners too? First of all, World Vision does wonderful things. Secondly, for those that are listening that might not be believers, you know, I share my faith with you because of what Jesus has done for me and because I would love to be able to show you that hope too, and not for any other reason, but it's he has changed my life. And he's changed me as a leader. He's changed me as a consultant, as an author, as a husband, as a father, and as a person who hopefully can reach out to those in need. So good. So please receive that with love.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for your time. I do hope we get to see each other face to face again sometime. I don't know when we're all going to be flying again, but
I don't know. One thing at a time, but today is the first day I've been back in my office in 2 months.
Wow.
So we're moving in that direction, God willing.
I love Patrick Lencioni's energy. We ran out of time. We could have spoken all day. When you see Pat speak on stage, there's something about him that's magnetic. He's in the moment. He's in the zone with the audience. And yet he lowers his guard and lets people know how nervous he's feeling. There's something about the humility that Patrick talks about that he models in his life. And this is a vital leadership. Humility as one of the defining features of true leadership is something that the Bible has taught right from the beginning. Jesus himself described himself as a servant. He said in Mark chapter 10 verse 45 that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. If ever there's an element of leadership that is neglected in our society, humility has got to be the missing one. This is the Leadership Podcast, and I'm Krish Kandiah. Please rate and like us wherever you listen to this podcast. Let other people know how they can go on a leadership too. Join us again soon for the next edition of the Leadership Podcast.